From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, ISIS on a roll, oil spill in Santa Barbara, TPA, NSA, and bye-bye David Letterman. Ramadi fell to the Islamic State this week. Here's their video celebrating.
The conquest of Anbar is just the beginning of the conquest of Baghdad, Najaf, and Karbala. Now the conquest has begun. Now the fighting has begun.
A pipeline break sent waves of crude oil onto the beaches of Santa Barbara. The Environmental Defense Center's Linda Kropp.
You know, I know everybody says there's no good place for an oil spill, but this is one of the worst places to have an oil spill.
And David Letterman leaves late night after 33 years joking with bandleader Paul Schaefer about how it all began. Here's Letterman one last time.
Remember that?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Half of the people said, that show doesn't have a chance. On the other hand, the other half of the people says, that show doesn't have a prayer.
That's a remember that.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Lisa Desjardins of the PBS NewsHour, Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What now? On ISIS, TPP, NSA? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from Washington, Lisa Desjardins, political director for the PBS NewsHour. Lisa, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
And joining us from Philadelphia is Trudy Rubin, columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer, herself not long back from Iraq. Trudy, great to have you with us.
Great to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Lisa, and Trudy.
Sound here from Ramadi. Gunfire. A little clip there from a Kurdish network, and of course, in came the Islamic State. Out went the Iraqi troops. Trudy Rubin, we hear now about militias massing outside Ramadi, maybe a counterattack, maybe even by the time some of our listeners hear this. Could this go right back the other way before the weekend's over?
No, I doubt it. When I was in Iraq, it was pretty clear that the U.S. strategy and the Iraqi strategy was failing badly. And although President Obama said this is a tactical setback, and the administration has stressed that, this is a strategic setback. It just proves that retraining the broken Iraqi army is a long, long process which may never work. They fled, and that we have failed to press the Iraqi government to arm and let us really train Sunni militias in Anbar province who are the ones who could fight back against ISIS, as they did against al-Qaeda in the middle of the last decade. So this is not going to turn around quickly. And what is really worrisome is that ISIS is now trying to move on a big air base that's between Ramadi and Fallujah. If that should fall, it would be a real disaster.
Early in the week, the White House was kind of trying to downplay this. Pentagon, too. Here was Josh Earnest. This was on Tuesday, defending or at least downplaying what was going on in Ramadi.
Are we going to light our hair on fire every time that there is a setback in the campaign against ISIL, or are we going to take very seriously our responsibility to evaluate those areas where we succeed and evaluate where steps are necessary for us to change our strategy where we've sustained setbacks?
The White House not ready to light its hair on fire over what was happening in Ramadi, but plenty of Republicans were. Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, said the president's to blame for the fall of Ramadi. Here he is in a Fox News interview on Monday.
Taking Ramadi by ISIL really is a blow to political reconciliation, and it's exhibit A of the failure of Obama's military strategy. We don't have enough American forces in Iraq to change the momentum on the battlefield.
Lisa Desjardins, Republicans were all over this week. Let's look at the politics of what's going on in Iraq.
Well, I think the statement that I paid the most attention to from Republicans this week was actually from House Foreign Affairs Chairman Ed Royce. He's someone who has generally been more statesmanly, should I say, in approaching conflict with the White House, especially over military matters. He's kind of one of the more old school Republicans that way. He has not been sharply critical of the Obama administration on this and said he's sort of been more, let's figure out our strategy. Let's talk about what we're doing. But he came out with a statement Wednesday night that was very sharp. He said, quote, It's dreadfully obvious that we're not working well enough to defeat ISIS and protect the people of, in that case, Palmyra and its precious relics. But this statement from someone who was trying to find a way to support some kind of strategy from the Pentagon as a Republican is a real sign of that now really the president does not have any foothold on Capitol Hill. And it also seems at the same time that we've got a problem with even his war authorization. A lot of listeners might be following the president's request for an AUMF, as we call it, the authority to use military force. Mm-hmm. Well, this week, House Speaker Boehner, Tom, said that the president should withdraw his request, that the request was far too limited, and that it had no chance. So we really saw a terrible week politically for the president on these matters, as well as we saw on the battlefield.
Just wild. Precious human life being lost. Precious relics at tremendous risk here in Palmyra. This was an archaeologist out of a UPenn on NBC, Catherine Hansen, talking just yesterday about that ancient city. What could be lost there?
If we lose Palmyra, we lose one of the top cultural sites in the entire Middle East. Watching ISIS's intentional destruction and blatant encouragement of looting at archaeological sites and cultural sites throughout their held region has been devastating.
Jack Beatty, what do you see going on here? I mean, this is real advances on the Western Front, on the Eastern Front, and a strategy that seems to be in a kind of disarray. Maybe they'll knit it up, buff it up, and bring it back. But this was not, as Lisa and Trudy say, not a good week.
Not a good week at all. And in his interview with The Atlantic, reprised in The New York Times this morning, the president is all about military strategy, build up forces, command and control, commitment, you know, arming the tribes. Whereas on Lisa's show last night, a former ambassador of Iraq to the United States said, that's not what this is about. This is about political reconciliation. This is about the will to fight. And he pointed out that for nearly a year, a piece of legislation has been pending in the Iraqi parliament that would have created National Guard units out of Sunni forces and essentially trained them up and given them a capability to fight. That legislation has not passed. It's been a victim of the sort of Shiite politics in the capital. And, you know, a year ago, the president said, we're not going to be the air force for the Shiite militias. Well, we appear to be that air force. And you know, it's as if there's no end to the mistakes in that laboratory of American hubris that is Iraq.
Of course, you've got the Shiite militia. They went into Tikrit, brought it back, but then trashed the place. You can hardly blame Sunnis for being very leery about that. Trudy, I hear you, but let me get a couple of calls, and I'll bring it right to you, Trudy. Mike in Waterloo, Iowa. Mike, you're on the air. What do you think?
I don't know why we're over there in the first place. We have enough oil over here now, and let them Sunni and Shia fight it out. What do we care about it anyway?
That is a big attitude in the land right now, Mike, and we hear it loud and clear. I appreciate your call. One more, Gabe in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gabe, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Tom. You know, in some ways I agree with Mike there, but I think that, you know, and not to blow us out of proportion, okay, I think this is the biggest threat to Western civilization, you know, since the Nazis, really. And we need to start taking it with that level of seriousness, meaning, you know, a lot of the partisan bickering that's happening, we got to can it. You know, we got to start acting like we're actually at war and deal with it appropriately.
Gabe, how do you see that? Because Mike is willing to just leave it over there, as he says. You see it as the biggest threat to Western civilization since Nazism. How would that play out?
Look, you know, I mean, I would love to leave it over there. I also think that, you know, that is a bit of our strategy. I mean, we do have many more players now stepping up and taking responsibility for their own issues than we did. However, you know, all of this is the legacy of the Iraq War. You know, and I was, you know, I'm totally against the Iraq War, but honestly, I think I'm against the way in which we pulled out, too, because, you know, it didn't leave it correctly.
Gabe, we've got it. Trudy Rubin, let me bring it to you. And let me ask you first this. Is this a must-win for the USA? Does the Islamic State have to be, rolled back, put away, wiped out? Can we leave it over there? And what about the Republicans saying it's all Obama?
Well, let me start about whether we can leave it over there. I do think that has been, in a sense, the administration's strategy to try to sort of contain it and dump it on the next White House inhabitant. And it simply isn't working because ISIS is gaining strength. It is not being pushed back. ISIS is both a political and a military problem, mm-hmm. and it will go on for a long time. But if left unchecked, which is essentially what the administration has done with a policy where there has not been enough attention and commitment, then it spreads its tentacles throughout the region and becomes a greater terrorist threat because it gathers more support from disaffected young men in the region, in Europe, ultimately in the United States. You could see threats to allied regimes in the region, and ultimately it will blow back on the West. So it can't be left to expand unchecked. And what the administration has failed to do is both political and military. I was in Iraq. I was in the north of Iraq. Many tribal leaders from Anbar are in exile in Erbil, in the Kurdish region, and in Amman, Jordan. And they all said the same thing.
Sunni.
There is no coherent program to train and arm us, and there is no real pressure on the government in Baghdad to reach out to us, reconciliation.
To Gabe's point, did Obama make this mess?
No. This is a joint project, a bipartisan project. This mess was created first by the Bush administration after our invasion. I won't even get into the stupidity of going in, but after our invasion, one of the first things that was done was Paul Bremer, our viceroy, disbanded the Iraqi army. I was sitting about 10 feet from him in an auditorium in the presidential palace, Saddam's former, and that created hundreds of thousands of soldiers with guns who were dumped without pensions or severance. I interviewed many on the same day, and they all said the same thing. We didn't fight. You told us not to fight. We did what you wanted, and now we'll fight you after what you've done to us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. ISIS on a roll, oil spill in Santa Barbara, airbag mess, TPP, NSA, bye-bye, David Letterman. Trudy Rubin is with us from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Not long back from Iraq, a lot of experience there, and of course a lot of news out of there this week. Lisa Desjardins is with us, political director for PBS NewsHour. Jack Beatty is here, and you can join us. Lisa, just a minute more on the Islamic State and American strategy. Do you see a significant shift coming of some kind, and what would that be?
I think the problem is that we have a leadership issue here, and it's in both Congress and the White House, that there isn't a clear solution yet being presented. And also to say that I think this is going to be a massive issue in the 2016 campaign. And so far, we haven't really seen any well-detailed plans from our 2016 candidates. There are some who say we should put more troops on the ground or not, but we really haven't seen any realistic, well-drawn plans yet from that group.
Greg writes on Facebook, how much did it cost to create ISIS? Well, you could say, what, the $2 trillion price tag on the Iraq War. Frank in Northfield, Vermont. Frank, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
Okay. What do you
understand?
Say?
Hello, sir. Yes. I don't understand how we can beat the Nazis, but we can't beat this band of rebels. And if it was up to me, I'd bring everybody home. I don't like war, but this in-between has gone on for a bit too long here. Let's either defeat them really fast, we have the most powerful military in the world, or ideally get everyone out of there. But going this mid-route, it's just not working. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
I appreciate your call, Frank. I don't know. All out, you got a problem. All in, we did that for more than a decade. In between, it sounded appealing. I'm going to let that one stand right there. We're not going to solve that. We talked a lot about it yesterday, and we will again. But rough, rough week there. Lots going on Capitol Hill. NSA front, of course, that is still pending. What's going to happen with that mass data collection? The authority for that is expiring on Wednesday. Republican Senator Rand Paul, GOP presidential contender, took the Senate floor. Wasn't formally filibustering, but it sure sounded like it. Almost 11 hours talking against the Patriot Act, set to expire June 1st.
There comes a time in the history of nations when fear and complacency allow power to accumulate and liberty and privacy to suffer. That time is now, and I will not let the Patriot Act, the most unpatriotic of acts go unchallenged.
The most unpatriotic of acts. But here's the new Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, President Obama's Attorney General, calling on Congress to extend the Patriot Act, needed, she said, for national security, talking with CBS.
We run the risk of essentially being less safe. I think that we lose important tools. I think that we lose the ability to intercept these communications, which have proven very important in cases that we have built in the past. And I'm very concerned that the American people will be unprotected if this law expires.
Lisa, where does this thing stand as we speak? This could change. They're waiting for another vote. It may not be until Saturday, but where does it stand?
Right now, the Senate isn't even officially on that bill yet. The Senate is still stuck technically in the trade debate. And that debate, depending on exactly how much opponents want to gum up the works, the trade debate could even take another day. We may not even start the Patriot Act or Freedom Act debate until this weekend. Now, of course, it's the Senate and the senators have plans for vacation. So that makes a lot of us think that perhaps things could speed up a little bit. But the ultimate problem when it comes to the NSA is that there are not 60 votes for any one plan right now. It seems there are not 60 votes for what the House passed, the USA Freedom Act, which basically would pull back on that Section 215 program, the one that allows the bulk collection of the phone data, as you were saying. The House bill almost does away with that bulk collection power entirely. The Senate seems to have the most votes for that idea, but still not 60. So that's a problem. Then Mitch McConnell has an idea. How about a 2-month extension of the whole thing? No, there's not enough votes for that either. So what's happening at this exact moment is Mitch McConnell, also the Senate Intelligence Chairman, Burr of North Carolina, they're trying to figure out maybe a very short-term extension, maybe 2 weeks to kick this down the road. The truth is right now, Tom, this is a lot of drama about a hugely significant program, and it's not resolved.
Boy, I mean, talking about 2 weeks, that is hardly sort of grappling with the big issue here. Watch this space, listeners. By the time you hear this show, this could have changed. It may not be until Saturday. It may be, who knows when, but not a resolution on the NSA front. And then there's the whole trade package. Mm-hmm. I got to ask you here, Lisa, are the steps that have already been taken, again, as we speak, in effect, green lighting what they call the fast track for this?
Certainly on the Senate side, this battle is over in the Senate over the fast track authority. The key vote was yesterday. And I have to tell you, Tom, watching the floor, it was really incredible. You could see if they had 58 votes for the bill. They needed 60. I think they had 36 against. There were a lot of Democrats on the fence. And you saw Mitch McConnell standing there with Maria Cantwell of Washington. Patty Murray saw these key Democrats. He was almost literally twisting their arms, but he got a deal out of them, and then all of a sudden everyone votes yes. That was the key vote yesterday, and it came down, without getting too much into the weeds, to a deal over another piece of trade policy, the Export-Import Bank, which gives loans from the federal government to sometimes very large corporations, sometimes small, that want to compete overseas. Some Republicans say that's a dinosaur, it needs to go, but folks like Maria Cantwell, who has a certain company called Boeing in her state, want to keep it going. So they made a deal that to try and extend, have a vote on export-import later. But the point is, I think the bigger point is that this is going to happen in the Senate. The fast track authority will be approved. But the issue is going to be the House, where I think the landscape is much less clear.
That issue, we're not finished with it right here. Our listeners aren't finished with the Patriot Act. Paul in Des Moines. Paul, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I guess my main concern with the Patriot Act is there's just a basically just saying it's for your own good, it's for your own security, just makes Americans incredibly uncomfortable. I think they'd be a lot more comfortable if some of this stuff could become declassified and we could understand what it's being used for and the evidence that there is a purpose for it.
Let us pick it up. Trudy Rubin, when Loretta Lynch says we need it for national security, by your lights, does the record of how it's been applied, used, prove that out? Do we know?
You know... I think that we are stuck in a place where we're going to be debating this for the next several years, whether or not it's extended, because the inability to have a clear strategy to deal with groups like ISIS is going to leave the country in a state of suspended animation over terrorist attacks.
Because the threat will be out there.
The threat will be out there. We are better off than Europe, but you're going to have these lone wolf attacks And it is going to create a climate in which there, I think, will be a lot of support for less control over the Patriot Act than is probably warranted in a democratic country.
Watch that one. And I want to bring it back to the TPP. I mean, there's so much resistance against this within the Democratic Party, the president's own party, plus you've got some Republicans against it. But just a sound of that, what you may hear, will hear more of when it gets to the House. This is Sherrod Brown, a Democratic senator out of Ohio, venting with the process on the floor during the debate on Thursday when essentially the green light in the Senate for fast-track approval was given.
We're fast-tracking this whole idea of a fast-track process. Why is that good for our country? Why is that good for our workers? Why is that good for our small manufacturers and the supply chains of all these big industries? Why is that good for our communities? We've waited 8 years, and this has to be done today, Mr. President. And we had one full day of debate, and then the majority leader shut down the debate.
Jack Beatty, what are you thinking about the TPP trade deal debate and its progress so far, where it's headed?
Well, it seems to be headed for at least passage in one house, and it looks like there might be a majority if they could get it together in the other. Who knows? But you know, just the way the Times describes this, you say to yourself, "What side am I on?" This is now from a straight news story. 13 Democrats broke with the Senate leadership to back the president. All right, that's Obama, giving manufacturers, farmers, Hollywood studios, and pharmaceutical companies a huge lift. So they're all happy, while knocking back the coalition of unions, environmentalists, and liberal activists that oppose the trade accord. So are you with the, you know, who's represents the public interest there? Do the liberal activists, do the environmentalists, or do the Hollywood studios? And more people are looking at this deal. I mean, Paul Krugman, who is a, you know, wrote a book 20 years ago called Pop Internationalism, attacking Robert Reich and others who were, criticizing trade agreements. Mm-hmm. He has come all the way around now, and he says, you start to look at the fine print, and things have leaked out in this proposed accord, and some of the fears that Elizabeth Warren has raised look warranted. The fears about displacement of workers certainly seem warranted by the past, and it's as if the administration will not bring forward what may be its strongest argument, namely China. Will we write the rules of trade in that part of the world, or will China? And that is a strategic argument that sort of complicates the trade thing, but it puts a bigger strategic rubric around it.
Trudy, there's the whole domestic economic piece, which is gigantic. And then there's the foreign affairs piece here, which is China and the whole Pacific. How do you see this? Is this essential to American vigor in the Pacific in this century, Trudy?
I think... The problem is you can't summarize it like that. I mean, because American vigor also depends on job creation. American vigor also depends on whether the inequality that is growing as it is so rapidly keeps on in this direction. Mm-hmm. So if you don't know the fine print mm-hmm. in the pact, if you don't know whether it might help the economy on the one hand but harm job creation on this side of the Pacific, then it's hard to give an overall analysis because the domestic health of the country does affect the international. And frankly, if you don't know the answer to the question Jack Beatty posed, mm-hmm. if you don't know whether you're going to have a level playing field with China, then you don't know whether it's going to be helpful in the bigger picture where China is becoming more aggressive, having a more aggressive and more active foreign policy than it ever had before, including one that has a military aspect in the seas off of its coast. So I don't think you can neatly sum it up as to whether the pact is going to be what we need in our relationship with China. You have to break it into its parts and look at it, and we don't know enough details.
Lots to get into there, and you can't just break it down to one or two issues. Everything intersects here. Of course, lots of rumination in Washington lately about China and strategy there and whether the U.S. is being alert enough to that rising strategic challenge, as many are seeing, with multiple warheads put on nuclear weapons and all the rest. Speaking speaking of trade, I want to look at airbags. Takata, this Japanese firm, and now nearly 34 million airbags being recalled. Here's National Highway Traffic Safety Administrator Mark Rosekind speaking on Wednesday.
As far as we know, this is the largest recall in auto history. Others are doing research and suggest it could be one of the largest, if not the largest, in all of consumer recalls.
34 million, that is a mind-boggling number. How do you even know if it's your car? How do you know how to respond to something this big? Here's Rosekind again.
The big question is, how long is this going to take? Nobody knows that yet. There is no question. It could be some years. What do consumers do in the meantime? They need to get to the VIN lookup. If they find that their car, their inflator is covered, then they need to call their dealer and make an appointment to get their inflator fixed.
34 million. Can you imagine the line at the dealership? Debbie in Pepperell, Massachusetts. Debbie, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm calling because my husband has worked in car dealerships for the past 30 years as a service manager. Now, one of our cars, unfortunately, is on the recall, so we're not using that car right now. So we're kind of lucky that we were able to do things, you know, with our own other cars. But my question is this. So with my husband working at dealerships from small that maybe have one or two loaner cars, to much larger dealerships that have maybe five or six loaner cars that are usually only for like 1 to 2 days, maybe a week tops if somebody has a lot of work
right. That
has to be done. Where are all these loaner cars coming from, and how are they supposed to get to the people, the consumers? Because I'm confused. He's confused. I mean, I understand, you know, the safety thing is huge, but who decided that loaner cars are going to be there? Because dealerships usually don't have that many.
I mean, loaner cars, yes, as a very practical, more than a metaphor for what this means. Lisa Desjardins, think about 34 million. And when you see, I mean, of course, the odds of it happening to any one of us, not great, not large. But when you see the photographs of people who've had these things explode in their faces, it's sort of, no wonder he's confused. It's mind-boggling what a number like this means.
Right, it's really one of the more terrifying scenarios you could have in your
car. You're driving around all the time and boom, face grenade.
And suddenly a shard of metal comes flying at you.
Thanks.
Yes. I think speaking to Debbie's question, being realistic, now I know much less obviously than Debbie and her husband about the car industry, but just looking at the numbers, as you're saying, 34 million, I can't imagine that everyone, for people to get this fix made, people are going to have to go without their cars. I think that's really realistically where
we're
at. But
who's not minding the store? 34 million cars with defective bags were not sold overnight. That is years of car sales, and somebody's not paying attention.
That's right. And I think what's interesting here is we've seen a shift from the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration for the first time on this recall. Instead of having the dealers be the primary ones responsible for replacing the parts, although they will be doing the work, this for the first time, the agency is directing probably the entire problem toward the parts manufacturer. And I know that might sound like a subtle point, but it's a shift in how the agency does this. They are putting the full responsibility financially and kind of the go-to point to the parts manufacturer on this. And perhaps this speaks to part of the problem here is that we've been putting the onus on dealers and car manufacturers who really are just the compilation of all these parts from all these different places.
But that's in
we need to look
it.
At these other parts, these manufacturers. Yeah.
But in monitoring in the first place, is this a party thing? Is this a Republican, light oversight versus Democrat, stronger oversight or something else?
You know, I don't know. I've got to look into that more. I don't sense on this issue that it is necessarily. It could be we need to look more closely at how NHTSA has been looking at parts and when they've been put, because this isn't a brand new situation. They've known for months, even years, about this.
Hi, this is Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for listening. Audible.com is our sponsor today. Audible.com carries over 180,000 book titles, plus magazines and newspapers. Many of the books we talk about on the show can be downloaded and listened to whenever, wherever you want. And as an incentive to get you to try the service, they're offering On Point listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint, download a free title, and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint to get started today. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, in the wake of the biker gang bloodbath in Waco, Texas, 170 arrested. Bond set very high, $1 million. His Waco Police Sergeant, Patrick Swanton.
Their bond has been set at $1 million because our legal system in Waco, Texas, takes killing nine people very seriously.
Of course, media reports say some of them, maybe four or five, may have been shot by the police. After 8 years, the AMC series Mad Men ends with John Hamm's Don Draper in a hippie retreat on the California coast. His protege, Peggy Olson, tries to get him back to New York City and the world of advertising.
McCann will take you back in a second. Apparently it's happened before. Don't you want to work on coke?
I can't get out of here.
He just can't do it anymore. And a celebrity send-off for David Letterman, top 10 style, as celebrity guests read the top 10 things I've always wanted to say to Dave. Here are Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Chris Rock, and Bill Murray.
I'm just glad your show is being given to another white guy.
Thanks for letting me take part in another hugely disappointing series finale.
Dave, I'll never have the money I owe you.
Oh, no.
It was pretty good. Trudy Ruman is with us from the Philadelphia Inquirer. Lisa Desjardins from the PBS NewsHour, political director there. Jack Beatty is here, and you can join us. In Baltimore, their feisty prosecutor, Marilyn Mosby, news conference yesterday, reading off the charges. Grand juries come out. Indictments have come down in the murder, the death of Freddie Gray.
Officer Caesar Goodson Jr., second degree, depraved heart. Murder, involuntary manslaughter, second degree negligent assault, manslaughter by vehicle and gross negligence, manslaughter by vehicle, criminal negligence, misconduct in office for failure to perform a duty regarding safety of a prisoner, reckless endangerment.
Marilyn Mosby can sure read off the charges, the indictments now, depraved heart murder. Lisa Desjardins, that's one I don't even know. Mm-hmm. It's just up the road from you in Baltimore. Any sense of the timetable or how this is likely to play out over the summer? Or are we talking into next year?
I think for the end point where we could be talking into next year, but we just don't know yet is the thing. And on the depraved heart murder charge, that's a very rarely used charge. But that charge essentially says because of your decision not to help someone who was in distress, mm-hmm. It is the equivalent of sort of like having a hard heart. To the extent that it was murder, that you should have saved this person's life, you could have done it, and because you didn't do it, that's depraved heart murder. It's above a manslaughter charge. Also want to point out this week, Baltimore officials were at the White House asking for money to try and rebuild Baltimore, and there's a very open question as to whether they will get it and how Baltimore will rebuild from the riots.
Depraved heart murder. Throw somebody in the back of a police van, handcuffed, no seatbelt, they're on the smooth floor going back and forth, broken neck. You can imagine how that could happen. Of course, charges against big banks as well this week. Very big banks. We're talking about Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase, Barclays, Royal Bank of Scotland, pleaded guilty of a series of federal crimes, a scheme to manipulate the value of the world's currencies. Here's again U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch laying out the scheme in pretty stark terms.
Starting as early as 2007, currency traders at several multinational banks formed a group that they dubbed the Cartel. It's perhaps fitting that they chose that name, as it aptly describes the brazenly illegal behavior that they were engaged in on a near 5-year basis.
Jack Beatty, note the dates here. This is largely after the meltdown that began the recession. Lots of money made. Big fine here, multi-billions. But those cops in Baltimore are looking at serious charges, murder charges. The bankers are looking at money. There's a lot of money where the banks are.
There sure is. And, you know, these fines come in the same week, Tom, as the release of a study. It measures the ever-normal depth of Wall Street's ethical swamp. A third of 1,200 Wall Streeters surveyed said they had, quote, firsthand knowledge of wrongdoing in the workplace. Nearly 20% felt that people in their business have to cross the line to succeed. Nearly a third believe that Wall Street's bonus compensation system invites that behavior. Many said their employers would retaliate against witnesses and some whistleblowers, and some said that they had been asked to sign confidentiality agreements barring them from reporting wrongdoing. The bottom line, as summed up of this study, is summed up by Andrew Ross Sorkin in The Times. The legislative and regulatory responses to the greed that you know, created the economy in 2008, quote, appear to have had little deterrent effect. Fines like those levied on the banks aren't enough to cleanse Wall Street's cankerous culture to drain the swamp before it swamps the economy again. Criminal prosecutions probably are as necessary as, unhappily, they are rare.
But they are not here, and they've got a traitor at Barclays in an online chat room where prosecutors say this was all hatched. Quoted him writing there, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. Okay, great. That makes me real confident. Claude in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. Claude, you're on the air. Thank you for calling. What do you think? On police, on Wall Street? What do you think, Claude?
Hi, Tom. Well, my comment is simply this. I don't think that our politicians that sit behind a desk all day have very much experience in dealing with street riot situations, no matter where they occur. So we should let the police decide what kind of equipment they need to handle the situation.
On the you're talking the equipment. The President Obama this week saying no to bayonets and tanks and some kinds of rocket launchers or grenade launchers, I think.
Yes, yes. I mean, sometimes it's just there for intimidation as well as being helpful to deal with the situation. But we need to let the cops decide what they need to use in order to control things.
Well, Claude, let's just sit with that for a second. I mean, yes, you want to give the police some latitude for judgment here, but as a citizen, do you really want the local police department coming out to greet you with military equipment, rocket launchers, bayonets?
Well, I don't think cops would come out to greet you with that sort of thing unless there's a situation that requires it. You know, in a particular neighborhood situation. I mean,
well, what does that mean? Not your neighborhood in Bloomfield Hills?
Well, yeah. That would be one of them, but yeah. Certainly in a neighborhood that requires that kind of control, how else are they supposed to deal with it?
Oh, man. A riot is tough, and I get it, but Lisa, you started getting into that, you know, where you're going to put tanks and rocket launchers out on the American public versus right. Where you're not. I mean, this is dicey territory. Hold the thought. Let me just play a little bit of the president on this. He went up to Camden, New Jersey, which he was holding up as a kind of beacon of doing things better, announced that the government would take steps to somewhat demilitarize local police, saying that military gear gets in the way of good policing, the president.
Now, we've seen how militarized gear can sometimes give people a feeling like there's an occupying force as opposed to a force that's part of the community that's protecting them and serving them. Can alienate and intimidate local residents and send the wrong message.
Lisa, I watched Ferguson along with everybody else last summer. I saw the cops up on top of those huge military-style trucks with assault rifles aimed at the crowd. I didn't want that pointed at me as an American citizen, but what do you make of this?
That's right. And I think we have to watch in the next couple of days. We've now seen another sort of situation in Olympia, Washington, where two young black men who were suspects in a robbery were shot by a police officer, and there's protests there. I think that we've seen the first shift from all of this has been on those weapons that police use on that issue. And I think we're now seeing this firm stance that I don't think a future president will remove, which is that we have to be much more careful about how we arm our police forces. And we need to, I think this gets farther into what the president's task force has said, that we need to find other ways of engaging the community. And that the onus from the president's task force has said is on police to try and get on the ground one-on-one with their communities. That's obviously very difficult, and it's very difficult for police officers who feel threatened and are under threat. But that's what the president and his task force are saying, not weapons, but one-on-one engagement.
Trudy, you get around all over the world. I mean, what do you make of the scenes we have seen of heavy military equipment in the streets in this country? Is it right for the president to rein it in?
Yes. Ferguson, Baltimore, they are not Iraq. I have seen Iraq. Furthermore, even in Iraq, as we discussed earlier, there is a political component. In a sense, the minorities, the Sunnis, were part of a political process, if they felt they had a future, then they wouldn't be welcoming ISIS with open arms.
Yeah.
It's a gross comparison. But clearly, You need community policing. You need minority police. Bringing in the tanks and the bayonets is just what you need to convince the community that it can't deal with law enforcement, that it must continue the don't snitch policy, and that the police are the enemy. It's totally counterproductive.
And yet we put a lot on the backs of police when we don't confront bigger social issues, let them boil and bubble, and then they're facing trouble. Jesse in New Orleans, you're on the air, Jesse.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Just wanted to mention that as a citizen of New Orleans, we see a lot of corruption and a lot of things on a local level that I think have really affected police's ability to reach people on a local level. And it's gotten to the point where we need national support. We need a national focus on what's happening at the local level to wake people up and get them involved.
And what are you thinking of there, Jesse, when you say that? Not paying attention to what? Get involved in what?
Well, I think we need to get people involved in their community policing as opposed to getting police to just start policing more frequently. It seems to me that adding more equipment and more training to police that involves, hostile tactics almost terrorist-like tactics. I hate to use that term, but it seems that we need to start getting more community leaders involved as opposed to more guns and explosives involved.
Yeah, Jesse, thanks for your call from New Orleans. Jack Beatty, only a few weeks ago there was a lot of fear about a long, hot summer here that we could see a real boiling over. Who knows now? As we see it, do you feel that out there today, Jack, or has things simmered down a little bit?
I think that Baltimore prosecutor helped in that regard. I think that took some of the fire off the some of this off the boil. But that's one place. The president really, I think, put his finger on it in Camden, and really what he said was the police are being asked to play a larger role. He says to be a police officer takes a special kind of courage. We can't ask the police to contain and control problems that the rest of us aren't willing to face or do anything about. And of course, the rest of us includes him. I mean, until Forced by Ferguson, he said little about black poverty and really has done less to mitigate it. But that is the issue. We can't expect the police to be our social our social workers to deal with the consequences of years of indifference, of segregation, of American history. This is a national effort.
But neither can they be just. It is clear now, not monitored. That can get bad too. 28 days with no questions from the press, and then Hillary Clinton this week spoke with reporters, talked about her use of private email to handle government business as Secretary of State, called for the State Department to get those emails out in public.
I have said repeatedly, I want those emails out. Nobody has a bigger interest in getting them released than I do.
And talked about the nearly $30 million she and Bill Clinton earned in speaking fees over the past year and a half or so.
Obviously, Bill and I have been blessed, and we're very grateful for the opportunities that we had, but we've never forgotten where we came from.
Lisa, was this a Hillary tells all week, finally takes questions, lays it all out?
Not quite. She did need to take those questions, and I think that certainly that helped her with the press. Now, whether that matters with regular voters, I'm not honestly sure. But I think that much of what we learned about Hillary Clinton this week did not come from her, but instead came from revelations from the Clinton Foundation, for example. New information out of them today that, in fact, they had not disclosed dozens of speeches worth somewhere between $12 and $26 million that Hillary, Bill, and Chelsea had given. They donated that money back to the foundation, so they didn't get personal profit off of it. But still, that's a great amount of money that they are earning, in one case, from the government of Thailand. That's a real issue when she was Secretary of State. So new questions there. Also, we're getting new emails from her time about Benghazi. We're learning a lot of different things about Hillary Clinton this week. Now, those who support her might take solace in that it's coming out now, not a year from now. However, this does add to a storyline that's a problem for Hillary Clinton. Is she transparent? Is she honest? So far we haven't seen any shift in polling on Clinton, although maybe polling doesn't matter right now, because people to begin with, had a question of trust with her. Those who vote for her believe that she is smart and capable. They're not concerned about issues of trust.
And so, two more back-to-back here, if I may. Here's Santa Barbara County District Attorney Joyce Dudley talking with CBS News about the broken pipeline and all the oil on the beach.
I don't know if this is a crime scene yet, but as I look across this ocean and I see these rocks covered with tar and oil, it almost feels like blood.
Almost like blood. And let's put it up against Jeb Bush, another presidential contender, talking about climate change, not necessarily due to human behavior, he said in New Hampshire this week.
The climate is changing. I don't think the science is clear of what percentage is man-made and what percentage is natural. I just don't. It's convoluted. And for the people to say the science is decided on this is just really arrogant, to be honest with you. It's this intellectual arrogance that now you can't have a conversation about it even.
Trudy, it's not clear. It's convoluted. This is a man who would be president from the GOP side. Is that fair?
I think it's what he has to do to play both ends against the middle. He's probably too intelligent to know, not to know, that he can't dismiss climate change out of hand. On the other hand, if he wants to get nominated for president, he has to appeal to a base that believes that climate change science is nonsense. So he's trying to present a convoluted theory that will offend nobody, but it probably will offend everybody.
Oil on the beach, ice caps going. It's 2015. Jeb Bush says science is not clear. Convoluted. Convoluted, Jack?
I'm not a scientist, Tom.
Oh, boy. Everywhere I turn, nobody is a scientist. We've got to get some scientists in here. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Trudy Rubin, always wonderful to have you with us, especially fresh back from Iraq. Thank you so much for being with us from the Philadelphia Inquirer today, Trudy.
Thank you.
And Lisa Desjardins, political director at PBS NewsHour. Great to have you right here, Lisa. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's an honor.
Have a great weekend. Memorial Day weekend, everybody. And remember to remember, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.